Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Issue 32. Ben Stark of Wondermill Films. Franco Usmile of Dawn of the Dead.
Hello, Franco.
Oh, hi, Ben.
Oh, hi. Okay, so you and I both saw Inside Out on opening day. Not, you know, near each other at all, but on the, you know, within a few hours. And I think you and my wife are the only people that have seen the movie that have actually talked to about the movie. So I thought it would be fun to, you know, talk about it, go full spoilers on everything.
Starting now.
Starting right now.
Yeah.
And just kind of see, you know, what you think about it and kind of go from there. I guess, first of all, I mean, in our box office, summer box office preview show, we talked about this movie a little bit, and I talked about how it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like one of my most anticipated movies of the year, but in the last few months, I really started to think about how big of a movie it could be, you know, culturally. I'm kind of doubtful of that now that Jurassic World has made so much money. I feel like there's only so much pie out there for movies.
Can I interrupt you there?
Yeah.
Sorry. But the Friday numbers came in, and it's going to be around a $90 million weekend. So there's a lot of people going to the theaters this weekend with that. And Jurassic World, you know, will probably make around the same amount. Yeah, it'll probably make around the same amount as Inside Out. So that's just a lot of people going to the movies this weekend.
Well, this summer, I mean, that's another show entirely. But this summer has been just really great for Hollywood, which I'm okay with.
Yeah, I mean, so I do think that I think 90 million is good enough for like second best opening weekend for Pixar after Toy Story 3. So for original property, that's like pretty high concept for a kid movie, especially. I think that's an all around box office and artistic win.
Excellent. Well, I mean, that's one thing is that there must be market penetration. Because I, bad theatrical experiences have been kind of a theme on the show recently. I think a lot of it is because we're watching movies on opening weekend because it's summer. But yesterday during the movie, we sat next to these little kids that were there not with their parents, and they were reciting lines from the movie, so. They must have seen the trailers, like all the materials, like 1,000 times to know, you know, the beats of the trailers and the lines so well. And at some point, these kids were super smart. They were actually, like, whispering to each other the plot points before the plot points would happen. They would be like, oh, you know, Hockey Island is about to crumble. And I was like, wait, hold on. I didn't even think about that happening. You guys are way smarter than me. So we actually got up and, like, moved. And I'm sure the kids either didn't care or thought we were jerks. But it was one of those moments where I was like, do I shush these little girls? No, I can't do that because that would be terrifying.
Well, it's a Pixar movie. It's like for them, right?
Exactly. And that's another thing. I was like, well, I'm the one that shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be here at 5 o'clock on a Friday. I do wish that their parents would tell them not to talk during movies, but, you know. They were, otherwise, they were very smart
kids.
Well,
their parents should be there. Come on, parents.
Yeah, it was a little weird.
Just one of them.
Yeah.
Well, so you saw it at 5 o'clock on a Friday. I saw it at 1 p.m. here in California. So I think we overlapped 1 hour. And my theatrical experience, it was 1 p.m. on a Friday. School's out for me, so... It was very exciting to not go at night. And there was maybe like 30 people in the theater. Almost everyone was there with their kids, except one other group of like 4 20-somethings, and they were like kind of, you know, hipster Pixar nerds. just like, I guess, me and my wife, because we were there with no kids also. And thankfully, nobody talked. I think once I heard like a parent explaining something to like a 4-year-old and I turned around and I saw that and then I was like, okay, I guess that's acceptable. Yeah. And, you know, I'm in a Pixar movie. I'm the weirdo here, not that.
Yeah. And again, and it was fun. It's opening weekend. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, before we get into the movie itself, do you want to talk about Lava, the short that was ahead of it, or no?
Yeah. Are you talking about the movie where a sad male volcano screams while he drowns? Like, there's a shot in Lava that is, like, is seared in my memory of this giant, volcano, Jabba the Hutt-looking volcano. That
yeah, like a slubby volcano.
Yeah, he's, like, drowning and screaming and, like, sobbing uncontrollably. It's like, oh, my God, what am I watching?
Right.
Yeah, so, it's a music video, which is, you know...
I thought that was really neat.
Right.
And I liked how it was, like, very Hawaiian, I guess. I don't know. Like,
yeah.
The content, the music, I mean, I'm not an expert in Hawaiian culture. I've never been there, but from, I guess, stereotypes, it seems Hawaiian. And I thought it was very cute. And as it went on, I was like, oh, it's maybe less cute, but I still liked it. It made me feel gushy inside, which is a good place to be right before Inside Out. And then I went online, and everybody hates this short, like, so much.
Yeah, I've read a few things, too, that I'm not sure. I don't know I can't drum up any sort of hate for it. I did like it. My expectations for Pixar shorts, for Pixar proper shorts are on the whole, are actually pretty low. I actually went through and watched every Pixar short ever last year, I think, and ranked and rated them all on Letterboxd. And if you take out the Mater shorts, Pixar is a fan. It's like their batting average, which is a term that I barely understand. But their average quality is extremely high if you take out everything having to do with cars. Unfortunately, like almost half of their output is cars in terms of shorts. So if you count those in, Lava is an above average Pixar short.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I enjoyed it. I thought it was very creative and clever to have it basically be a music video. And I'm assuming that the people at home, since this is spoilers, have seen Lava.
Right.
So no need to explain it because we've both seen it. But
exactly.
I don't know. It was very kind of sad and melancholic, and then it turns happy. And it was less satisfying because, I don't know. I mean, this is going to sound very stupid, but the physics of it didn't work for me anymore. Once once she, like, shot up, instead of it happening over, like, millions of years, she just shoots up in an instant, and then he shoots up. But I guess that's the power of love and whatnot, and that was cool. But,
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe this is me, like... liberal 2015 guy, but like he's fat and schlubby and she's like this skinny hot volcano. Like, why did Pixar do that? It didn't make sense to me. She was like way too pretty just in
it's the King of Queens if the most characters were volcanoes,
right? yes good analogy.
I don't know, like I mean she looked way more like a person than he did.
That's true too. Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. It's tough. It's tough. I'm not saying that I didn't think about it. But I think I was just so floored by the geological like you said, the physics of it. Even if the physics are strikingly correct, a geologist would balk at what's happening at the short. despite that, I still feel like there's a element to it that is, it's really beautiful the way they figured stuff out, like when they're together and
their, you know, their, for lack of a better term, arms kind of wrap around and make a lagoon. I thought that
oh,
was
yeah.
really
the
beautiful.
Animation was very beautiful, yes.
Yeah, and just the way that it's figured out and like their you know, the break in between them is a waterfall, and it's just really creative stuff that it appeals to a more kind of ecstatic truth, if you use our Herzog term, to the whole thing, where it doesn't have to necessarily add up and make sense. It just looks right and seems right, and I guess for that to work, yeah, the difference in the way they looked, you know, she's not a shallow volcano. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wonder what polyamorous people think about this short, because it, like, everything that was alive was in love and in pairs. So that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, that, again, that would be another podcast.
Yeah, I mean, right, no, yeah, I mean, I'm just playing around. So, how did this make you feel? Like, it ends, the credits come, were you, like, ready for Inside Out, or were you kind
yeah,
of
yeah,
trying
I mean,
to
it's
figure
like that,
out
you know,
what was going on?
It's every time you go see a Pixar movie, and recently Disney movies, too, Disney animated features. There's that wonderful feeling where you see the production logo come up, and you know this isn't the main event. You know, this is a short, and I don't know what I'm going to get. You know, I know less about this short than I do about the film that's about to come on. And I remember for what came out in 2012, it was Brave. Before Brave, the short was La Luna.
That one's
good.
That one's really
that's
good.
One of my favorite Pixar movies, and I had no idea what it was, and it started, and I was immediately taken with it, and it was just, it really whet the appetite, and I mean, in that case, it was, I mean, I liked it more than Brave, you know? So, I think even, like, part of it is seeing all those names that work on it, you know, and it's kind of reminding you that, hey, this is Pixar, you know, these are the people that are working so hard to make these movies, and the guy that made Lava may be directing, you know, a Pixar feature in the future, and that's always exciting.
Yeah, totally, and I think with the shorts, it's like, it's like a stage for the animators and the creative thinkers to kind of think outside the box and stretch their muscles, because it's a short, so they can be a little bit more out there with their creativity and seeing what sticks and playing around with form. Because, like, La Luna, it doesn't have any dialogue, right?
It's just, no, yeah, holy, it's entirely visual. Yeah,
I mean, you would never see that in a feature. So it's really interesting to be able to see what they cooked up next. And so the people that you're with in general, when you see a Pixar movie, how do they feel about the shorts that come ahead of them?
I almost exclusively see movies with my wife. So she's on board.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. I mean, I think, maybe her only annoyance is that I, like, look at her with an excited look on my face. I'm like, ooh, it's a short. Like either of us didn't already know that. And she's probably like, yeah, yep, we're at a Pixar movie.
That's what they do.
This is what happens. So I think that's probably her only opinion other than that. I mean, I talked to her about the short afterward, and she liked it. Do you know people that have an issue with these things?
Yeah, I know people have said, like, I paid to see the other movie. Why are you forcing me to see this movie I've never heard of beforehand?
Oh, my gosh. Wow, that is an unfortunate stance. Well, I mean, I guess they're entitled to their opinion. But, I mean,
yeah,
again,
well,
like, are they surprised? Like, why not just show up late?
Right. Well,
I understand if you got tricked with Toy Story, but we're going on 20 years here.
Sure.
How is this still a surprise?
Right, and I mean, I also I mean, I really like it because I'm nostalgic for a time that I didn't exist in. Like, back in the day, you'd buy a ticket for the day and you'd have a bunch of shorts and newsreels and like two movies and you just make a day out of it. And that to me sounds really, really cool. So
yeah,
I really like that everyone is made to watch these shorts because they're a dying art form. They're like, people do not watch shorts. They just don't. Not even people really like movies like us. Like how often do you watch shorts? Like, not that often. And I mean, I think you watch them more often than other people who really like movies. But I mean, how often do you watch like a live action short? Like almost never, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's usually somebody I know or, you know, something I hear about or an established filmmaker that I heard, you know, has good work. I mean, I like to equate shorts with features. You know, if I'm talking about a filmmaker's work, I like to be able to, if I have access, you know, consider the shorts and, because that's as much of a film as a feature is. But I also understand there's like, believe me, I understand there's a like very small market for short films. I think that studios could maybe do a little bit more. I'm a big fan of anthology films. I think if they collected, you know, a handful of Pixar shorts and put them in theaters as, you know, Pixar Anthology Album 1 or something, the production on that would be very cheap. You would probably make money if you could just train the... I'm a big fan of the studios have tremendous more control than they realize and can train markets and can train audiences to consider these things a little bit differently than they do right now. So I think that, you know, anthology films could totally be a thing, and we could kind of get back into watching shorts, but that's probably not going to happen. And with
right,
YouTube,
I mean, Grindhouse failed, so then the double feature was out the window, and
right.
You know, it's all, you know, people in charge of studios are humans, so like most humans, they're going to make decisions kind of to, like, hedge their bets or out
yeah,
of fear
based on what they know. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Cool.
So the main event.
Yes, the main event. You know, I've been mulling it over, and I was like, man, should I, you know, I just to get our opinions out there, I've been mulling it over, and I've been trying to be mature about it, but I think I have to just go all in and say that Inside Out is the best movie I've seen in a theater since The Master. I think, and before
so
that...
3 years.
Yeah, and, like, before that, like, Tree of Life. You know, I think that the experience that I had yesterday in the theater is a big deal. And I think this movie is a very, very, very big deal. I think it's great, obviously, but I also think it's great for us. You know, humans, and I think that it may be the best thing Pixar has ever done.
Yeah, maybe. So I'll just put it out there too. It is my number one of 2015. I haven't thought about if it's my number one of the last few years, like it is for you. I just have not thought about that. Is it better than any movie I saw last year? Yes, it is better than any 2014. Movies last year.
Yeah. I've loved movies, but I've given whatever A plus or 10 out of 10 or whatever to several movies since The Master, but it's times like this I'm like, man, do I give out 10 out of 10s too freely? And no, I don't. You know, if I love a movie, I love a movie, but I think there's a transcendence and a greatness to a film that I have to absolutely acknowledge, and this is one of those times. So okay, so you're in on it, not necessarily as much as me, but certainly it's up there for you.
Well, I thought you had a rule where you didn't give 10 out of 10 on any
exactly.
movie in the first viewing.
Exactly. I do have that rule.
And I couldn't help it. Okay. I have to. Hey, I mean, rules are rules are helpful, but
and they're made to be broken. Then
apparently,
yes.
So yeah, I mean, it's that strong. And the same thing with the master. The second I walked out of the master, I was like, well, that's the best movie I've seen in quite some time. There's, usually I have to wrestle with a movie or consider it or something like that. Sometimes it's just, boom, I know it. And there may have even been a moment in that movie or this movie where I just knew it, but I don't know if I'll land on it. But who cares what I think? What about the movie itself? Like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of a good entry point to talk about the movie.
Well, I feel like the need to preface some things, because this is going to be kind of unlike any other discussion about a movie that I've ever had, or at least for a long time, because I really like being cerebral about movies. Like, I enjoy them mostly on an intellectual level, and if they're firing on all cylinders, then I get an emotional reaction to that.
Yes.
I rarely just get like stage one emotional reaction to a movie. That just doesn't really happen for me for whatever reasons. And so I usually can talk about a movie and have my points and have reasons and deconstruct and tell you why this worked and why that worked and then this shot and then that structurally is uneven or whatever, like real film dork stuff. But with Inside Out, I was just being pummeled by my emotions, which is very fitting, I suppose. And it hit someplace deep in me and personal. And it really brought me back to being the age of the protagonist, which is 10 or 11. And then going through that and realizing that I never got that moment of realization that the kid gets at the end of the movie where she embraces her feelings and talks about them and then she evolves. And I've known this about myself. But seeing it in a movie, it just made me very emotional and hit me on a spot that no movie has in a long time. So therefore, those feelings are really clouding how intellectual I can be about the movie itself, the craft and the themes and all that sort of thing. So I just wanted to preface our discussion with that, because like I said, I'm not very emotional when it comes to movies. I would say I've never cried in a movie before. The closest I ever gotten was when Mufasa died in The Lion King.
So yes.
Did not see that coming because I was 11,
yes,
or 10, and I did not know that that could happen in movies yet. So, but in Inside Out, I got close twice. I got very close twice. And then we can talk about that later. Emotionally impacting parts. But do you have anything to say? Kind of overview.
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point about that. The balance between emotional moments and structural fortitude or formal consideration. I think a lot of times I'm usually like you, if a movie is constructed tightly and visually, coherent and uses, film grammar, in the right ways, whatever I determine is the right way, that's usually what I really respond to. But every now and then, I think these are the movies that hit me the most are movies that do that beat that drum of what I consider to be formal kind of ingenuity and consistency and strength. But then, boom, hits you with a moment, a real moment out of nowhere. And this movie did that a number of times. I think I may have landed on the moment where I realized that this was a great film, and it's when the characters of Joy, Sadness, and Bing Bong go into the subconscious, or not the subconscious, rather, but the area of abstract thought, and they start to devolve, and they... As they devolve, they take on, you know, different forms of art, where they become, you know, kind of 3D Picasso-esque paintings. My art history is pretty weak here. And then it becomes kind of cubist, and then it gets as simple as line art. And that moment where I realized not only are they pushing the boundaries of, you know, mainstream feature film animation, they're also illustrating... you know, psychological concepts through art, you know, art history visuals in a children's film. Like, the fact that they were doing all of those things formally, you know, and structurally, that's when I realized, wow, this is amazing. And then there's an emotional moment after that, where it totally hit me emotionally, and I realized that, oh, this is all working perfectly, and it's so far beyond me being outside of it, you know, as this objective, stodgy viewer, but this is an experience that I'm having. And I'll go ahead and say it. I'll go ahead and go there. I totally cried.
Good for you.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't actually... ever do that. I think the last time I may have gotten a little bit like moist eyes.
The Master.
no. I was definitely glued to the screen, but my eyes were dry. The year before with War Horse, that definitely gripped me. There's a few really, really touching moments in that got me. But before that, but like this was like active tears, like coming down my face, like I was like trying to make sure nobody saw me kind of thing. And I think the last time that may have happened, I'm not even sure if this actually happened, was at the end of Fellowship of the Ring, which was 2001. So I'm not the kind of guy that cries in movies, but this movie did it. And the way it did it was, the character Bing Bong, who which is something we call our cats, my wife and I. So it was a term of endearment for me already. And then it's this imaginary friend, I'll tell you what happened. So you know, they fall into the kind of valley where forgotten memories go, and memories are fading here and there, and he sacrifices himself so that Joy can get out of that area, because he realizes he's already a fading memory, and it's too late for him, and she watches him fade from Riley's memory.
Keep going.
Well, so in that moment, that's when the tears happened, and of course, Pete Docter amazingly kind of let the last thing that fades out are his giant, you know, cartoon eyes. So it's totally a heart-wrenching moment anyway. And so I was thinking about that. I was like, man, was I just manipulated? Was I just exploited? And then I remembered when that character was first introduced as Riley's imaginary friend that she played around with. When he first, earlier in the film, was introduced, in my brain, I was like, I remember having an imaginary friend. I don't remember what it was. And I think feeling stayed with me until that moment, and that's the overwhelming sadness of forgetting, of memory loss. You know, it goes back to Chris Nolan's Memento. Just that when you feel yourself forgetting the way somebody's face looks, having not seen them in a long time, or the way somebody's voice sounds, that's one of the great tragedies of life. And
it's not that this character died. It's that this character was forgotten. And Riley, it didn't even register with her. You know, the same way that whenever I forgot my imaginary friend, it didn't register with me. It just kind of, you know, faded away as the real world, you know, took precedence in my life. So there's a lot of complex stuff going on there, and I feel like that the fact that I that there's so much there is just another testament to that these filmmakers are just on fire.
Yeah, I mean, Bing Bong, so that was one of the two scenes where, like I said, I almost cried. I don't remember having an imaginary friend, so I didn't have that, like, if I did or not. So I didn't have that connection that you had. But what got me was, and a big part of this was the craft from the filmmakers, was how they allude to it, because Bing Bong, after the second failed attempt, he looks and he sees that his arm is fading even more than it had been. And then he says to her, come on, let's go one more time. I have a feeling it'll work this time. And right then I knew. I knew, but Joy didn't know. And so the whole time they're going, I know what he's going to do. And then she doesn't know. She doesn't even notice. And she's so happy, but I was crushed because he was sacrificing himself. And, I mean, we see that in movies a lot, right? And it doesn't really register. And, you know, like the end of Armageddon has that even, you know. Sorry.
Is that the one where Bruce Willis is made out of? Is that the one where he's made out of cotton candy? And he cries candy?
I think he's going for that.
Sorry, I'm thinking of Color of Night. You keep going.
Color of Night? Oh, wow. Nice. It's actually striking distance when he has a cotton candy gun.
That's right. That's right.
Going back to this, I think it hit, like, a nerve with me, like a deep fear or anxiety that I have for, like, the meaningless of existence, because he's just going to fade into memory, and it's like he never existed in something.
Yeah.
And the fact that he chose that, he chose that avenue.
Yeah, it's not death. Yeah,
things that are alive do not do that. So I thought it was just very, very touching. And like you said, something about his eyes going last. I actually don't remember that because I think I was looking down when it happened. Because you were crying.
You're not admitting it, but you were totally crying.
I was probably holding it in.
So what was the other moment that you...
That I almost cried? It was at the very end when she reunites with her parents, and, you know, I'm just like, okay, whatever, that's what you do in movies. They hug it out, and then she cries. Like, in any other movie, that would just be a regular thing. But because it's about the emotions, we go in her head, and then we see that Joy defers to sadness, and sadness becomes in charge of that moment. Because everyone realizes that sadness is not an emotion to avoid. It can help you grow. And that killed me. That killed me because it wasn't something I realized until my mid-20s. And so it made me think about being her age and how great it would have been to embrace that back then, and how different some things might have been for me if I had done that.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, and you're kind of, you mentioned it kind of like Riley realized this, but one of the things I love about this movie is that it is a story about a little girl, and it's a story about emotions, it's not a story about Riley becoming emotionally intelligent. It's a story about
her growing these emotions and the way these emotions change. But it's not really about her relationship to the emotions. So it's,
right.
it's this movie that can teach kids that isn't, it's a movie that's not about teaching a kid emotional intelligence. But because of the way that it portrays emotions, it automatically is going to make any children that watch it actively more emotionally intelligent. And I think that emotional intelligence is one of those things that a massive amount of the globe is missing. You know, it's we just do things based on how we feel. We don't actually think about why we feel that way. And therefore, we don't think about, you know, if the actions we take based on those emotions are the right decision. So there's a utility to the movie there that's brilliant, but also it's brilliant because it doesn't preach. You know, the movie doesn't preach. It is cinema. It tells a story. It shows you things. It uses shapes and colors to communicate character. And at the end of the movie, you have an applicable action that you can take to your life, and yet you were never told to do that. And that's one of the fascinating things about it, is that they never have that epiphany for Riley. It basically all happens with these tiny adjustments of a look on her face. And that alone, the fact that this is a 3D animated movie, and, you know, they're able to communicate so much in the performance of, you know, a little digital girl, is amazing. I'm kind of all over the place, clearly here, but
I think that's okay, because we just had a very emotional reaction to the movie. So I think our discussion about it, it just kind of has to be that way too.
Yeah. But yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess to restate it, it's a movie about emotions, and it is emotional, but it's not about being emotional. You know, it's not about following your feelings or doing whatever your feelings tell you. It's about knowing your feelings.
I wholeheartedly agree. It's not really her, like, learning it on, like, an intellectual level. It's her just experiencing it now that way and growing and becoming more mature because of that. And I also think it's really interesting how, you know, there are some adults who think that, like, joy should always be in charge and every memory should be a joyful one. And, you know, we all work with some people like that. You know, there's always that person in the family or whatever who just wants everyone to be happy. And I'm definitely have been one of those. And I think maybe I continue to be like that because, you know, maybe I'm uncomfortable with other emotions. But I think that the movie really does a great way in conveying that, like, there's room for all emotions and they can all be positive even if they don't feel like they are. And the movie does a great job in not preaching it, like you said. Like, there's not really any conversation where they, like, say what they learned, joy and fear and all of them. But they just kind of show the emotional growth and the positive effects of learning that.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a movement in our culture that wants children to avoid pain, wants children to avoid sadness in particular. I don't know what that comes from. I don't know, you know, what kind of trauma that our culture went through or has gone through that we feel like we need to shield kids from that. But it is something that as an adult I've had trouble dealing with when things aren't great. You know, it's like, why do I feel this way? Like, why can't I just be happy despite things aren't, you know, things not being great? I would rather be happy. And it's one of those things where as somebody that's dealt with depression, there's a lot of times a mistaken, people equate depression with sadness, but really depression is exactly what she goes through in the film, you know, when she's on the bus. And her kind of emotional control panel is shutting down.
depression isn't sadness. Depression is the lack of sadness. It's the lack of joy. It's not being able to connect at all emotionally. One of the great cures for depression is just acknowledging it and being, you know, being sad and sharing it with people and having other people share it with you. This is good for the kids. It's good for their parents. It's definitely good for me. As somebody that, like you said, as an adult has trouble, kind of figuring out the utility of the certain ways I feel, a lot of the times. One thing that I think is really fascinating I love that there's no attention really drawn to it in the film. I'll put a pin in that. So, one nitpick I'll have, a cheat that they make, and this is as a new father, when Riley is born, her first emotion is joy.
I was gonna ask. Yeah, I was thinking about that because I was like, they come out devastated.
Yeah, it's fear.
Traumatized.
I would say joy didn't show up until maybe 3 or 4 months for my daughter.
Please don't say that.
I'm sorry. It's just not there. Basically, it's fear the entire time. But, you know, it's Bill Hader. You know, everybody likes Bill Hader.
I have a kid due in a week.
I know.
Today.
Oh, man. Yeah. So
exciting times.
Yeah, it is. But it's, you know, that's the little nitpick I'll make. But whatever, you know, they you know, maybe Riley is a particularly, you know, joyful kid. But all that to say that one thing I noticed that if joy is kind of like the predominant emotion in this little girl, and she's kind of the head of the headquarters, the emotional headquarters in Riley's head, I noticed that in the mother, the sadness character was kind
and
of
and the father was anger,
and it was an anger in the father. Yeah, and it's two things that they never really. I mean. I don't know. Like, I feel like another movie would have like done something with that, but they just subtly do that, and maybe it's perpetuating some sort of stereotype. But I think really it's just telling us something about this.
I think so. No, totally. And about adults, like adults, you grow up, and if you're not careful, anger, fear, sadness, those are going to be in control of your emotional panel, and that family seems pretty. Pretty with it, but really we don't see the inside of their heads until, you know, they're already in San Francisco. So, to be fair, the problem with Riley was that Joy was trying to still be in charge and it was just inappropriate for this new situation. So, maybe mom and dad, emotional kind of panel knew that at that, you know, for like
yeah,
that
they week, needed a guiding
joy.
Kind of,
exactly. You know, Joy was not the one, and maybe they could have harped on it a little bit more, but it did seem like the parents' emotions in their heads were more collaborative than. Riley's, because you grow up and you have more nuanced feelings.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, I took it as that in adulthood, like you said, they kind of developed, you know, a lead emotion. But yeah, you're right. They were more of a, you know, there was more of an equitable kind of thing. But again, I the fact that they don't draw an awful lot of attention to it, I think is fantastic. And I think it shows a character, you know, it gives us more idea of what their characters are subtly without beating us over the head with a monologue or, you know, or some sort of thing like that.
Yeah. What did you think of, speaking of all the emotions in the head, what did you think about the idea to end on like a fun little gag of going into all these different types of people and mammals? Head.
I loved it. I thought that was fantastic. I laughed inappropriately loud when it cut to the cat
and her the cat's head was just totally empty. And I feel like a better gag there would have been to just leave that exactly with that one frame of the empty empty.
See, that one I didn't understand. I didn't understand because I've never had a cat. I thought cats were really smart and like mischievous.
They are. They are because they're totally devoid of emotion.
Oh, right.
When you look at a cat, like when you look at a dog, you see so much going on. You see so much feeling going on, not necessarily thinking. But when you look at a cat, it's literally, it's like, I could be looking at this cat, or I could be laying here dead, and the cat would be looking at me the exact same way. And they do have feelings, and they come out in different ways. But
just not in the eyes.
Yeah, exactly. It's more through motion and stuff. So if it showed the dog and he was, you know, thinking about food and everything, and then it cut to the cat and it was just empty, I felt like that was like the perfect gag. But then they have it basically a bunch of cats kind of chaotically go in, which is also true, in that cats are emotionless, but when they are emotional, it's completely unpredictable and totally, you know, doesn't really add up. So the joke still works, but like I said, whenever it just went to an empty control, like, I think my wife may have been embarrassed by the screaming laughter that exited my mouth.
That brings me to another thing, and although let's go there. That brings me to another thing because I didn't hear many kids laughing. Granted, there were probably like 10 kids and then like more adults because a lot of kids came with two parents. And there weren't many like groups of multiple kids, if any. It was like only child day at my theater. And so when you're with a group of your kids, friends, family, it's easier to like laugh out loud because it's communal. But it was a relatively empty theater, and I just didn't, I know the adults laughed out loud more than the kids. Was that the case for you?
No, we had way more kids. I mean, our theater was sold out. We got there with like 10 minutes before the movie started, and it was a theater where you pick your seats, and like,
okay,
there were like maybe 10 seats left, and we had to like sit like really close up front. And then so once we got in there, it was filled to the brim with kids. And yeah, I mean,
was this a 2D spot?
Yeah, it was 2D.
So was mine. I just figured kids went to 3D or maybe it was 1 o'clock and that was just too early for me.
Maybe it was too early. It was definitely packed. And yeah, they laughed more at the physical humor, you know, when fear or whatever would run into a wall and splat against the wall and stuff like that.
Sure.
So, but there was a pretty even, I mean, that was one thing that I was kind of worried about, is that was this going to be, you know, alienating to children? And I don't think it will be. I think even if a kid doesn't quite understand exactly what everything means, I think they're still going to have a really good time, like a really good adventure.
I mean, can't wait to show this movie at like the last day of school to sixth graders, because that's like the right age to like be thinking about this sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, I've got a niece who is going to turn 9 this year, and she's super artsy, and you can always like tell when you're talking to her that she's like, you know, thinking about like 4 other things in addition to what she's talking about. So she's at a similarly kind of perfect age. So I'm kind of curious to see what she thinks about it. I think that this is such there's a movie that I was thinking about today that I feel like was trying to go for similar things, but did end up being alienating not just to children but also me. Spike Jonze's Where the Wild Things Are.
Not a kid's movie. It's for like emo adults.
Yeah, it's a movie that wants to get into the utility and the realities of sadness, but it doesn't do anything constructive with it. You know, it's just basically shows sadness and grief and loneliness as this destructive force that, you know, maybe we can control it, maybe not. Who cares, really? Arcade
Fire.
Well,
Spike Jonze was married to Sofia Coppola. I mean, they had to bond over something.
Yeah. Yeah, so maybe not make kids' movies. But, yeah, I feel like this is such a better film, such a more entertaining film, and that really it doesn't skirt around any realities. I mean, I respect the movie for not dealing with grief necessarily. You know, like, I knew that going in, I knew that there was going to be a, you know, emotional thing that the character of Riley was going to have to go through. I just didn't know what it was going to be. And I'm glad that they went with something like a big move, because that you can run all the emotions, you can run all the gamut of emotions and everything through that, but you don't get to, it's not the stakes of like a family death, you know, or early on in the movie, I was like, oh, I bet the big emotional thing is going to be her parents getting divorced or something like that. Like, at the end of the movie, I was so glad that they didn't go to those heights, because, I don't know, I feel like that would negatively impact the stakes of what's going on inside her head. You know, that this is not a trauma for her. This is a growing experience, you know, and there's such a balance between that, you know, where if they had gone any less, you know, if it had been, you know, the hockey thing, you know, if she hadn't won a hockey game, it would have seemed like totally not big enough. But if they could have easily gone too far, had it been a really strained relationship or something like that.
Yeah, and with the hockey thing, like, they showed that how the sadness was helpful to get to the joy. And they just showed that with the flashback. And then we didn't need to hear anyone talk about it.
Yeah. And also they have that beautiful image at the end where there's a new memory that's you know, has like streaks of yellow and blue to kind of notate that weird emotion that we all have that we can't put our finger on, that kind of bittersweet feeling of, you know, when
it's more complex now. She's getting more mature emotionally.
It's like when you go to a funeral and you end up bonding with people you haven't seen in a long time or you don't see very often, and there's this joy and a relief there, but also you're also all grieving together. And it's one of those, it's just a beautiful cinematic image of this feeling that all of us can have, but none of us can really, you know, specify.
Yeah. It's like when you like have like the best burrito, but then it like makes you throw up later.
Well, right. Yeah. It's a lot like that.
Is that just me?
Yeah, well, I had a really bad burrito at a funeral one time.
Why was there food there?
That's true. What else is there?
So you had a nitpick that was like that is a nitpick because it was like specific to your life, right? So I would like to air a couple. One, when we go in the teacher's brain, and she calls on a kid, and then I forgot what the kid does, but it was not satisfactory. And then one of her emotions kind of does the countdown of how many days there are left.
Okay.
It was like a lot of days left. We don't do that. Like, we start the countdown after. So the kids start the countdown, at least in sixth grade. They start the countdown after spring break, which is around like 30 school days left. And so I just want to put that out there. I mean, I know it was a joke, but like it did kind of perpetuate that whole like teachers
are miserable.
Yeah. It's fine, whatever, it's a joke. And then another one was, so I live in San Francisco, so it was nice to see, like, a lot of the city, and they really did get, like, the narrow streets and the architecture and, like, the litter and all that, and, like, even, like, the colors of the signs and everything, the street signs, it's, like, black on white, which is how it is. But San Francisco is so much more culturally diverse than they showed it. And there were, like, no Asians in the movie, like almost anywhere. And there's a lot of Asians in San Francisco. So I thought that was weird, especially since Pixar is, like, 25 minutes outside of San Francisco. But anyways, that was just a little inside baseball nitpick.
Yeah.
That,
I don't remember.
That, like, does not matter whatsoever, but.
Yeah, I just don't remember too many of the humans in general. I remember her family and the teacher, but
right.
I don't remember
and,
any of the class.
And to be honest, if I was not here, I would not be looking for it. But I was looking for it because I was like, oh, how are they going to, you know, portray San Francisco? And, you know, it was funny. They, like, said, oh, you ruined pizza, San Francisco. You put broccoli on it. Like, you know, that was like, you know, organic and, you know, and that.
And the name of
like,
the pizza place was amazing. I already forgot what it was.
Oh, really? I don't remember what it was.
It was a really good gag name for a vegan or organic pizza place. I shouldn't have even brought it up because I couldn't remember what it was, but it was really funny.
Speaking of gags, what did you think about the Chinatown joke? The movie
that was kind of odd. Both, I'm glad they paid it off. The cloud thing, because when it first when the cloud guy got evaporated or whatever, I thought, well, that's kind of weird. And then they kind of
did he murder him?
Yeah, I was like, that guy just died. They totally paid off like every single thing in Imagination Land, which I love. But and they even paid that off, and it was, that was one of those jokes that I think I chuckled at, and yeah, I don't know, I feel like that's almost just kind of a Pixar thing that they have to, I think they are fully aware that they can go to, very great, lengths of tension, and they know they need to cut through the tension, even when it's not necessarily, you know, the most highbrow way to do it, like in Finding Nemo when the big thing explodes into the sea and, like, it makes a seagull think that another seagull tooted.
That's a pretty good gag.
It's a good gag, but it's not necessarily, like, brilliant. It certainly doesn't bring anything to the story other than just, you know, color, you know, and I think that that's a good example of that. I also assume that those clouds don't, that they come back. That couple wasn't just murdered by the hero of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I thought, like, if you don't know Chinatown, like, that must be so bizarre sounding. It just seems...
Uh-huh. That's one of those things I just love.
So, another San Francisco Easter egg thing. Are you familiar with the male gay world, the term bear?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so that was in, like, that was not, that was in the movie. They say something, I think fear is like, we can be attacked by he's talking about all the things that can happen. He said we could be attacked by bears, or a bear, and then somebody says, there are no bears in San Francisco. And then Lewis Black says, I saw a really hairy guy. And that was in the trailer. And I was like, oh, my goodness, Pixar just did a bear joke. And I mean, I doubt it was an accident.
But yeah, if it was an accident, I wouldn't be totally surprised because that could go both ways. You know, that's. In terms of, like, you know, if you said a gorilla or something like that, and, oh, it's just a hairy guy over there. Looks, but, yes, that's very specific. And I wouldn't put it, yeah, I certainly wouldn't put it past Pixar to make that joke. Yeah, I didn't consider that.
So, did you catch any Easter eggs?
No. No, I mean, I definitely, it's going to need to be another watch before I really,
yeah.
Like I said, the name of the pizza place was about the only, like, little side thing that I really remember cracking up about. Oh, but real quick, this isn't an Easter egg. This is a straight up joke. But at the end, when she bumps into the boy, and it goes into his head, and it's just like a red alert. Everybody is freaking out. Just as it's a movie that is told almost exclusively from the female perspective, which is I totally appreciate. And I think doesn't really, you know, I think it's so universal that it doesn't really, you know, matter one way or the other. But, you know, if you had to kind of think like, okay, what was I personally going through at that age? And they totally bottled it with that one beat. I was like, oh, that's why this is about a girl and not a boy at that age, because that's, at that point, it was just melting down about how to talk to girls, you know, almost every 5 minutes of my life.
Totally. I was just fear, right? Fear was in charge.
Yeah, fear was the predominant emotion and probably kind of still is. But, I love that. I feel like there's something else, like I said, the fact that they set up so many things, oh, that's right, they set up so many things in the imagination world. And they paid all that off, but I think one of my favorite things, and I think, again, this is kind of in that, was in the part of the movie where I was like, well, this is really great, is the whole motion picture, dreams as a Hollywood studio kind of thing.
Oh, I love that, yeah.
It's brilliant, it's brilliant, you know, and it's one of those things where that's like the theory of cinema, you know, that people have kind of poetically talked about, is that cinema is basically these waking dreams that we could kind of watch flicker before our eyes. And I think that it totally continues that kind of analogy.
But
also, there was a part where they showed like big movie posters, and one of the movie posters was falling into a very dark pit for a very long time or something like that. It was like for a movie, a dream, you know, titled that, which I thought was hilarious.
And I've had that before.
Of course, all of us have, yeah. And like this, the poster is like this Saul Bass looking kind of 60s design. It was just perfect.
I noticed the Saul Bass and I was like, yes, Saul Bass, all right.
Yeah. I feel like, again, this could be almost this whole episode, but at this point, do you have a Pixar MVP? Like, a guy that you're like, well, this guy is kind of the top, you know, this guy is the closest we can get to bottling Pixar in a single person.
Well, for my personal preference, up until yesterday, I would have said Andrew Stanton, because Wall-E and Finding Nemo were like my one and two.
And he was a huge, huge part of Toy Story. I mean, the screenplay.
Right, exactly. And Toy Story is probably, like, right after that. So, Monsters, Inc. and Up are one notch below those for me. But, you know, Inside Out is really up there. And I didn't watch John Carter, so I can't talk about...
well, that's not that it doesn't count.
No, I know, but it's Andrew Stanton. So, yeah. And I would assume that when we talk about him, we talk about everything he's done. Perhaps, maybe. But I haven't seen it. And I don't know. I mean, I would have to give the edge to Andrew Stanton. Because for me, Up is kind of uneven. It's all good, don't get me wrong. But I feel like they're different kind of movies battling each other.
Yes, I agree.
And yeah. Monsters, Inc. is a great kids movie, and it's a great movie, but it didn't transcend movies like Inside Out and Wall-E and Finding Nemo for me.
Yeah, Monsters, Inc. is, I think I rate it a lot higher than a lot of other people. I think it's just, I think it does a lot more than people give it credit for. I can't, it's getting late, so I can't pull up like my Monsters, Inc. Thesis. But I think I have to give the edge to Pete Docter right now, because Andrew Stanton is
a great screenwriting mind and a storytelling mind and a very strong director. Of course, John Lasseter started everything. Brad Bird, like, I feel like, you know, he has the Iron Giant and he has his outside Pixar movies and then he has his Pixar work and it's great. And it's going to, it's like the best, he's like the best director that they've got. But in terms of just Pixar, in terms of the guy that seems to be able to tell these, the right stories for Pixar, and the guy that has the cartooning background, I think Pete Docter is the guy. If you look at his character design, they're very similar to what you see in the movies. You know, his Sully and Mike from Monsters, Inc. are really fun characters that, you know, he clearly has an eye for cartoon drawings, and then is able to, you know, write and direct and, you know, animate them, or at least, you know, lead those departments to a finished piece of movie, you know, that works as a movie, not just cartoon art. And I feel like in this movie particularly, there is so much cartoon history wrapped up in this movie. I think any fan of Calvin and Hobbes is going to be thrilled by this movie. You know, there's like old Calvin and Hobbes strip where it's these little versions of Calvin in his brain working his motor skills and trying to save him from like falling off the last step on the stairs. Obviously, you know, Calvin and Hobbes, Calvin with his imaginary friend riding, you know, a radio flyer, you know, wagon down a hill and off of ramps and stuff. It's right there in this movie. So there's the Calvin Hobbes influence. There's the art, the cubist, and, art history aspects that I mentioned earlier. The Michael Giacchino score has like this Carl Stalling Looney Tunes element to it. There's, I don't know, I feel like there's like Walt Disney cartoon history in there. It just seems like this convergence of all these different animation ideas, and I think it could have only come from the mind of a true animation nerd, you know, or a comic cartoon nerd.
Yeah, I'll give you that. He's the most Pixar-y Pixar director. He's the most, like, guy who's made to be in Pixar, I think. Like,
yeah,
he's the heir to John Lasseter, I would say. All those people.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think he's the animation guy, and I think he's, you know, I think Andrew Stanton has, despite what John Carter made at the box office, I think it's a strong movie, and I think he's got a strong live action career ahead of him if he chooses to go after that. We know Brad Bird can excel in live action, so I think that those guys are, you know, they've got places they can go, but I think Pete Docter is. You know, it's hard for me to imagine Pixar without Pete Docter, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, my question is like, who are the, like, the new class? Who's in the new class? I know I really enjoyed Lee Unkrich's Toy Story 3 a lot. So,
yeah, I think he's definitely kind of, like, leading the charge of, like, the next, you know, Generation 2. But there's also Pete Sohn, who directed one of my favorite shorts, Partly Cloudy. He is directing.
That's a good one.
Yeah, he took over directing The Good Dinosaur. So, you know, depending on how that movie does, he'll probably be the next kind of, you know, top guy. And then, you know, Pixar also has its history of burning bridges. Brenda Chapman, who directed Prince of Egypt, came in and developed Brave and then got removed from that movie. And then Bob Peterson, who co-wrote Up and was the voice of Doug in Up, he was the director of Good Dinosaur before he got removed and replaced by Pete Sohn. So, you know, Pixar.
Yeah.
I really want to know what happens at Pixar when it's not all shiny, happy, perfect, you know, corporate.
Yeah, I'd love to read, you know, like the definitive kind of story,
the dark side.
Like the nonfiction book in like 10 years or 20 years.
Yeah.
What's the name of the guy who did Easy Riders, Raging Bulls? Like,
oh,
him.
Peter Biskins. Yeah.
Biskins, yeah. Kind
of thing.
Yeah.
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 Well, cool.
I mean, I'm pretty excited about this summer. You know, we had Mad Max. I dug a lot. This movie, Tomorrowland, like, I liked more than I disliked, and I liked that it was...
It's an interesting failure, even if you don't like it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Jurassic World was popcorn fun, big and dumb, but I had a lot of fun with it. I thought the pacing was good. Avengers 2, I didn't care for, but at this point, it's, like, harmless. Like, you know, you kind of know what those movies are, and I feel like they can't make or break my summer. I mean, it's just, like, Mission Impossible is coming up, and...
Yeah,
I'm pretty excited. Terminator 5. I don't know about that one.
I think Ant-Man has the potential to have a identity, you know, to it. I think it has the chance to kind of set itself apart. I feel like there's one big one I'm not thinking of, but yeah, I mean,
for me, Fantastic Four.
There's something else that I'm not thinking of. Yeah, I mean, for me, it's Mission Impossible. That's kind of like the next big milestone. But yeah, I agree. I mean, not only has it been a really really fun summer, which I liked all those movies. I still haven't seen Spy, which I've heard great things about. Trainwreck is coming up. It's also been, like I said earlier, it's been super lucrative, which is, it's great. You know, if you hear all these stories about, you know, theaters are dying, all you really need is this kind of summer where you get, you know, one or two near billion-dollar movies in the theater, and that'll really help the industry. And it helps that, you know, well, I mean, Jurassic Park making $500 million in its opening weekend doesn't really encourage the kind of filmmaking we all want, I think, unless you really like Jurassic Park movies, which I do, but I prefer my Jurassic Park movies made maybe a little bit differently.
Smaller.
Maybe smaller, maybe a little bit more, you know, tighter. But it's still, you know, it's not a bad movie. You know, it's not a Transformers movie making $500 million. Avengers is, if you don't like it, you don't like it because you're not a comic book person. But that is a super duper comic booky movie that is doing things that movies don't usually do, which I think is an encouraging thing. And then, yeah, of course, you've got Mad Max, which hasn't, you know, set the world on fire, but it's made good money. And hopefully it's going to encourage more films like that to be made.
And hopefully it's going to inspire, like, a new crop of...
It's definitely going to do that.
Directors.
I definitely think that. I mean, I think it's... Yeah, it was my favorite film of the year up until yesterday. I definitely think... And I was kind of, like, I had my arms crossed a little bit. And I'm the action movie nerd, filmmaker, dork, you know, so I feel like that if I was kind of had my arms crossed about it, then people that are smarter than me and better than me are really going to take the ball and run with it. So the last thing I'd probably need to talk about is at the beginning of the summer, we kind of positioned this in competition with Minions. At the time, I kind of mentioned how Minions... I didn't know anything about Despicable Me. This seemed like a kind of a harmless thing. I knew it was going to make $1,000 billion. I'm fine with that because it seems kind of harmless. After seeing this trailer for Minions.
That was terrible.
It looks like a nightmare. If Inside Out does, you know, a tremendous amount of good for, children's movies this summer, I feel like Minions could undo all of that, you know, all of the work that it does, that it will hopefully do in terms of creating smart kid entertainment, because Minions looks like lowest common denominator, just garbage.
Yeah, I mean, with, like, their fake Spanish-Italian language and the yellow fire hydrant situation where
it's
just
like like faux sexualized, kind of like, and like kind of violent, you know, with
the sword going through
the guy. Yeah, with the sword stabbing the guy. Yeah, it's Looney Tunes violence, but it's like, I don't know, like
it's just not clever. Like Looney Tunes, one, it was, you know, 70 years ago, like, okay, uh-huh. and two, it was so artful. I mean, I just did an episode about Looney Tunes short from the mid-20th century for my podcast, and I had to see a bunch for it, and it was, they're just so clever, and it was really good, and I know you're a big fan, so I'm just preaching to the choir here, but I would not even compare the two. I mean, I haven't seen Minions yet, obviously. It could be, I'm sure it's going to have some sort of, like, touching third act moment like they all do. I don't think there's going to be any pathos.
Yeah, like you said, I feel like they're going to try to couch it in some sort of emotional thing. But yeah, for the most part, that's the thing that's troubling is that they're bringing in people based on these kind of super cheap gags, and I feel like anytime underwear shows up in these kids' movies, that's like a really great indicator of something that's not for me at all.
Do you know people who like revisit the first two all the time, because it's not like Frozen where, like, you know, like the culture and kid culture was just like suffocated by Frozen. People were obsessed. And I think Despicable Me and the second one, they made close to $1 billion, but I think that just means everybody's seen it once or twice. Whereas I feel like Frozen, like, it was like a way of life for some kids. Like they were doing fan fiction and all this sort of thing.
Yeah,
and
Frozen.
Well, and I think like Inside Out is going to be maybe more of that than the other. Hopefully.
Oh,
that's like the best case scenario.
Absolutely. I think the thing that caught on about Frozen was the catchiness of the songs and the emotional relationships in the movie that so many kids can relate to. Which, again, is what's appealing about Inside Out, not the song thing, but the emotional, relational aspect of it. And Despicable Me has just, you know, a totally harmless and nice kind of father-child thing going on, and that's fun, but that's not what it hangs its hat on. It hangs its hat on just kind of goofy humor, which, again, is fine until it gets cheap, and it gets cheap so quickly, and apparently it looks like it's gotten real cheap real fast with this.
It's a case of diminishing returns, not at the box office, which is all that matters, but
yeah.
At the end of the day.
And it's sad because, like, there's so much, like, I understand, like, the excuse could be made that, look, these are, like, little silent characters that there's not a whole lot of depth that you're going to get out of it, so you kind of got to go cheap eventually anyway.
Yeah,
so
right. Give that to Pete Docter. He'd make
exactly.
it way
yeah.
better.
Or,
yeah,
or the guys that did that do like Shaun the Sheep or Wallace and Gromit, you know, the Aardman folks. You know,
yeah.
they work with silent comedy so well and so consistently that it boggles the mind of how many gags they come up with in a single episode of one of those things. And yet you've got this giant, you know, feature film that apparently they have to stoop to, you know, Starfish Bra or,
I
don't know.
Song. There's like a song joke.
Songs and like crotch shots and stuff like that. It's just like, come on. What are we doing here?
Yeah.
Just Ren and Stimpy.
Yeah. And even that was pretty smart.
Oh, yeah, that was subversive. But yeah. So
yeah.
I was completely okay with Despicable Me and Minions making whatever amount, but now I'm actively rooting against it, unfortunately, and I'm hoping that it's a big disappointment and that all of the Minions merchandising that I'm seeing everywhere winds up on a trash pile somewhere.
Yeah, all that trash. but you know what? Forget it. We got a couple weeks, to enjoy Inside Out being the top dog and being awesome.
Absolutely. Well, cool, man. Well, yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed the movie. I certainly did. Any last words?
No, just thank you for agreeing to do this episode with me. I mean, I texted you, and then I was like, I don't know if you're going to do an Inside Out episode, but I'm very interested in talking about it because it kind of, like, changed my life.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely...
I think a big part of it is because I'm about to have a kid in a week, too. Like, I forgot to mention that, but...
Absolutely, yeah.
Like, that just had me thinking about being a parent, had me thinking about being a kid, had me thinking about being... you know, this whole new stage where so much of my life now is, like, not really about me anymore.
Yeah.
It's going to be about being a better person so I can raise a well-adjusted, emotionally mature person, not just a happy person. And it just couldn't have come at a better time, this movie. So I'm glad it came now and not in a month from now. If it came out in late July, I'd be screwed. Probably wouldn't see it.
Absolutely. You wouldn't have. Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, yeah, and it is really, and there is an interesting kind of parent aspect to the Julie character, you know, where she has so much of her well-being and her personal identity in this child, and that's so similar to being a parent, you know, like you, if there's something wrong with them, you can't quite sit right, you know, until it's better. So yeah, I think. For me, the movie like that was Interstellar. I saw it a few weeks before my daughter was born, and so there's this tremendous sci-fi epic about a father and his relationship with his daughter. So yeah, for that, I was like, that was like the perfect movie that could have come out right now. Good thing I saw it because there's no way I would have seen it if it had come after. So yeah, your life is about to get pretty awesome. I'm excited for you.
Thanks, man. Yeah. Well, thank you again for having me on the show. I hope you all enjoyed it.
Yeah, and hopefully, as the rest of the film nerds see it, I'd love to get their takes too. So maybe they'll all, you know, maybe a few of them can record some reviews of their own. Because I don't know what anybody's going to think about it, but I'm anticipating a big reaction from a few key members of the Film Nerds team. So I'm excited to see more. I'm excited to talk to more and more people about this movie. And then the first person I talked to that didn't like it, it's going to break my heart. But we'll see.
Yeah, just don't go online, I guess. Not yet. It's too early.
Yeah, there's two negative reviews on it. And neither of them make any sense to me, but, you know, that's fine. Those people are entitled to their opinions.
Right. And, like, yeah, it's all about, like, where you are when a movie hits you, because you can't see a movie, like, in a vacuum, you know?
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't trust movies with 100% Rotten Tomatoes scores. You know? Something's up there.
That shouldn't exist.
It shouldn't exist. I agree.
For more from the Film Nerds, go to filmnerds.com and aspectradioshow.com.